At Founders Brewing Company, we set out to create a beer that lets you embrace the unconventional. Mortal Bloom is a radiantly beautiful, hazy IPA that will wrap your taste buds with intense citrus and tropical notes of pineapple and mango. Coming in at 6.2% ABV with big aromatics and no bitterness, it's the perfect beer, if we do say so ourselves. Visit foundersbrewing.com to find Mortal Bloom Hazy IPA.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
What is your emergency?
We need someone here at the Columbia Daily Tribune.
What's going on?
I'm not sure. I was just told to call 911. There's somebody hurt outside.
Is there anybody who can tell me what's going on there?
Here.
We're at the main building at the Tribune.
And what's going on?
In the parking lot, the sports editor, Kent, laying on the ground, pool of blood. Looks like he's been shot or something.
Okay, he's on the parking lot behind the Tribune on the KFC side?
Yes, yes.
Who did you see in the area?
I saw two guys in the area.
Were they white or black?
White. I'd say 19, 20.
What were they wearing?
I don't know. This gal, she saw them. She walked out to smoke a cigarette. Saw them duck down behind the car.
Okay.
I looked out and saw them, and I said, what's going on? I knew it was Kent's car, and I said, Kent? And they didn't look up. Nobody did anything. Somebody's been hurt, man.
Okay, so you saw them duck down behind his car?
Yes.
Okay, and then where did they go after that?
I don't know. Up towards the new building, towards 4th Street. I guess it's 4th.
So, just to make sure, though, he's down on the parking lot?
Yes.
And then all on these guys?
I don't, because they were close to 6 feet. Thin. One of them had blonde hair. Really, really short blonde hair. Did they either one of them have hats or caps?
They were headed towards 4th Street, so would that have been east or?
I'd say southeast, but I don't know that for sure because they took off, you know, and they went up that alleyway towards 4th.
All right, we've got officers on the way over there right now.
All right, we'll be out there.
Okay.
Bye.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me is a guy that less than 2 weeks ago, the mayor of Indianapolis gave him the key to the city. He is the captain.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's good to be seen and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
Today we are drinking Bobber Lager by the brilliant minds over at Logboat Brewing Company in beautiful Columbia, Missouri. Garage Grade, you know I love a good lager, especially in the warm months, and this is a great one. So Garage Grade, let's go 4.25 bottle caps out of 5. Bobber is an unfiltered lager brewed with inspiration from pale German lagers. And the noble hops provide a little bitterness, and my favorite part, Bobber has a crisp, clean finish. I was on their website the other day, and you know, sometimes a brewer will recommend food pairings with different beers. And for Bobber Lager, they recommend deer sausage.
And this lager is brought to us by these little fishes.
First up, we have Natalie from Grand Ledge, Michigan, who says, please give the beers to the captain because I think I have the hots for him.
Mm.
Well, look at that, captain. You still got it, buddy, all these years.
Never had it.
Next, we have Brianna and Brandon in South Dakota. We also have Aaron, who is a web sleuther turned private investigator in Fort Meade, Maryland. That's the old crab cake state.
And a big we like your jib to Kendra up in Ontario, Canada.
And we also have Meredith sending love from Hot Springs, Arkansas.
I've been to Hot Pants. I've never been to Hot Springs.
We also give a shout out to Laquelle in the Bronx. And last but not least, we have John from Western Massachusetts. He recommends Spencer Trappist Ale, and he says, obviously, here quoting Ferris Bueller, it is so choice. If you have the means, I highly recommend picking some up.
Do you have a kiss for your daddy?
So thank you to everybody for filling up the fridge for this week. And if you want to buy us a round for next week's show, please go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
And if you want to check out everything with True Crime, go to the website. We also have some shirts. We have the purple V-necks. We have the team captain tank tops coming out. And then we have the gray logos for the men. So check those out. All orders are shipped on Friday.
I must protest here. It sounds like there's no Team Nick shirt.
Yeah, well, we're working on a Team Colonel shirt.
It's like a team of one over here. That's enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. This is True Crime Garage. And this is the case of Ryan Ferguson.
How many times did you think you hit him altogether?
Just once.
Just once? The only problem I have with that is I know that he was hit more than once.
I just hit him once.
You just hit him once, you didn't hit him more than
no.
Like
because
10 times?
I just need to remember the first time that I hit him, I remember hearing this noise and just seeing his face, and it just made me sick.
If you only hit him once, turned away and got sick, you had to hand the thing off to Ryan because this guy's got head wounds all over his head. We're talking minimum 15 strikes.
I must have done it then. I mean, either that or I stopped and he did. I don't know.
Did you ever drop the pipe?
Probably.
Did you hand it off to Ryan?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Let's go back to when you were talking about how you saw Ryan strangle this guy. Now, we know what the guy got strangled with. That's kind of the thing I've been holding back from you.
Uh-huh. All right.
Is it possible that you know what he was strangling with and just didn't want to tell you? Because
I think it was a shirt or something.
I know it wasn't a shirt.
It's like maybe a bungee cord or something from his car. I don't see why he'd have a rope in his car.
Well, we know for a fact that his belt was ripped off of his pants and he was strangled with his belt.
Really?
Yeah. Do you see a belt in Ryan's hand? Something look like a rope maybe or a bungee cord?
I don't know.
So it's possible Ryan could have strangled this guy with his belt. You got the keys and you not.
Well, the guy's the man's belt?
Yeah.
His own belt?
Yes. Does that ring a bell?
Not at all. Like, I didn't.
But you saw Ryan strangling, though.
I thought, yeah.
Yeah, okay. You said this earlier something about Ryan wanted to choke him down to make sure he was dead. Is that true?
I think that he was, like, yeah.
Ryan Ferguson was convicted of the murder of Kent Heitholt. Kent's murder took place in the early morning hours of November 1st, 2001, in Ryan Ferguson's hometown of Columbia, Missouri. At the time of the murder, Ferguson was only 17 years old. He was a junior in high school. Kent Heitholt was found beaten and strangled shortly after 2 a.m. on November 1st, 2001, in the parking lot of the Columbia Daily Tribune. Kent worked there as a sports editor. The murder went unsolved for 2 years until police received a tip that a man, this is Charles Erickson, he was extremely drunk that night and he could not remember some of the events that took place that evening.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what took place around the time of the actual murder. After reading newspaper articles, Charles Erickson was having dreams about the murder. He told a couple of people that he had concerns that he may have been involved in the actual murder.
Well, and Chuck had a drug problem as well.
Correct. Charles Erickson was partying with Ryan Ferguson on Halloween night, October 31st. Now, this would be Wednesday night, but we all know how much everyone likes to party on Halloween. Charles and Ryan, they were doing quite a bit of underage drinking at a bar that night.
Mm-hmm.
And a party that had started in the evening earlier turned into partying into the early morning hours. Charles, or Chuck Erickson, would later confess to the murder of Kent Heitholt and implicate Ryan Ferguson in the murder as well. Ryan Ferguson was convicted in the fall of 2005.
And what you can hear in that trailer is the interrogation of Chucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was kind of a, what we just went through is a summarized version of the case, which we usually don't go through that and summarize the case for you before we
go
through
it. So now they can just stop listening.
Yeah, you know everything.
All right, see you guys next week.
Well, we usually don't do that before we go through it in detail, but we wanted to do that because with this case, it's actually very important that persons not familiar with this case have that information, because when it comes to Ryan Ferguson, not only was his innocence or guilt called into question before he was convicted, but both were called into question years after his conviction, which ultimately would lead to appeals trials, and then Ryan Ferguson's conviction was vacated in November of 2013. So I just wanted everybody to be aware of that situation fully before we go through the detailed account of what took place the evening of October 31st and the early morning hours of November 1st, 2001. So each of you can make a little mental note of when you think of, you know, at some points some things might point towards Ryan's guilt or if it would point towards his innocence.
Yeah, don't you tell me what to do.
Okay, let's go through a detailed account of that night. And first, we'll go through the police slash prosecutor story of that evening as what they pieced together off of eyewitness accounts and the confessor. This is Charles or Chuck Erickson, and we'll call him Chuck from now on.
And I'll call him Chucky.
There you go. On the evening of October 31st, 2001, as we said, many people were out celebrating Halloween. This including students from both of the city's two high schools. We will start the evening off roughly in the time frame of about 9 to 10 p.m. There are several Halloween parties going on, and the ones we are talking about have both high school age kids and young adults just out of high school at these parties. Ryan Ferguson is party hopping that evening, and as the night goes on, he's getting ready to leave a party, and he sees Chuck Erickson, who, as we said, he knows him from school.
Right.
Some have reported that Ryan and Chuck were hanging out that night together. Others report that Ryan offered Chuck a ride as he was leaving the party. I think either way actually works. It's not really important. So however it comes about, they are riding together in Ryan's car. Ryan tells Chuck...
Well, and let's get this clear too, because a lot of people report like that they're buddies. Kind of like in the West Memphis 3 case, where it's like, yeah, they're... You know, two of them were buddies and one was just kind of an acquaintance. In this scenario, Ryan and Chucky, they're just acquaintances.
Yeah, they know each other from school. They're the same age. They probably have a couple classes together.
Mm-hmm.
But from everything that I could gather, you're exactly right, Captain. It doesn't sound like they were not best friends. They really didn't even hang out a whole lot together.
Almost opposite sides of the track. I mean, we have an individual with Ryan that seems to be heavily involved in sports. You know, involved with his family and a lot of friends. And it seems like Chucky is kind of on the slacker side.
Mm-hmm. And they ran in the same circles, but the circle wasn't just the two of them. It was, you know, many friends that they had.
Right.
Anyway, so regardless of how they end up in Ryan's vehicle, but they're in his car. And at some point, either before the ride or during the ride, Ryan says to Chuck, you know, hey, let's go to this club. My older sister is at a club and she can get us in and we can continue to party. You know, we'll go there and have a few drinks, right? Okay, sounds great. So the two underage 17-year-old boys out looking for a good time, they meet up with Ryan's sister.
Well, and they're going to meet up at a bar called By George.
Mm-hmm.
And such a dumb name for a bar. Well, sorry if you own that bar and I'm talking about it. But
or if your name is George.
I don't mind the name George. I'm just saying By George is a kind of a dumb name for a bar.
Chuck Erickson states that the two spent up what money that they had once they were at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then Ryan's sister bought a drink or two for them, and then the two left, you know, because they were out of money. Once outside, Ryan is calling people on his cell phone. Now, I couldn't gather why Ryan was calling a bunch of different people, but I'm going to guess that Erickson, that Chuck, would have said possibility that Ryan was looking for someone with money to either join them at By George's,
right,
or looking for another place to go party. Because what Chuck Erickson would say is that Ryan said next would imply that Ryan was not done partying for the night. So with no one left to call, Ryan tells Chuck, hey, man, let's go rob someone so we can get enough money to get back into the bar and have some more drinks.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, here's a plan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it happens every weekend. How many times you're at a bar and your buddy says, let's go rob somebody so we can drink more?
Well, before they leave Ryan's car, they take a tire iron or one of those tire changing tools that come in the trunk of your car.
Mm-hmm.
They take this item, and so they walk to find their potential robbery or mugging victim. Well, they spot 48-year-old Kent Heitholt. Kent, as we had said, Kent is working late at the Columbia Daily Tribune. This would be approximately 2:15 a.m. or so. Now, I do want to point out here that several people were working at the Columbia Daily Tribune that night, early morning hours, whatever you want to call it. And the times, well, most of the times we give during this detailed account are going to be more approximate times for most of this stuff. We do not have exact times. For one reason, we have our main witness, which is Chuck Erickson, who ends up confessing to being a part of the crime, implicating mm-hmm. Ryan Ferguson. Chuck had fully admitted he was so drunk and high that night that he had been drinking, doing Adderall and cocaine that night. So quite the concoction inside of him.
Well, damn, Chuck, he slowed down.
And, well, he admits to being so messed up that he cannot remember most of the night. So there's one reason of not having exact mm-hmm. times. But what we will figure out here is that almost in the same breath that I say that, I'll point out that we do know that these times from the other eyewitnesses are close or somewhat accurate because we are dealing with such a small window of time that they have to be close, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we know Ryan and Chuck spot Kent at approximately 2:15 a.m.? Well, Michael Boyd, he is another employee of the Daily Tribune. He's working. He's a writer, a part-time writer. He says he left work sometime before Kent Heitholt did.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows this because he left around 2 a.m. And on his way out, he stops and he has a short conversation with Mike Henry. He's a night custodian at the Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Boyd walks the parking lot and he gets to his car. He will have to actually pass Kent's car to get to his own car. Then he goes out to his car, and when he's out there, he sits there for a little bit of time listening to some music when he sees Kent leaving work and going out to his car to leave for the night.
All right, why would you just get in your car and listen to music for a while before you leave?
It seems strange to me at that hour.
Right.
You know, especially at that hour. Michael pulls his car up alongside of Kent's, and they have a discussion. According to Michael Boyd, this conversation, it's a work conversation. It takes place sometime between 2:12 a.m. and 2:20 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Boyd says after the conversation, he leaves in his car and he goes to drive home. As he's pulling out and into the alley, he says that he nearly hit someone. He sees two people in the parking lot.
Right.
This is not Kent. Kent is not one of the people that he's describing here.
He sees younger people, right?
Well,
does he not make that claim?
To be clear, all he says is that Michael sees two people, and he cannot tell if the people are male or female.
Okay.
No description of the people.
Anomalies, almost.
Yeah, so these two people could be Chuck and Ryan because they would have to have arrived sometime in this time frame to the parking lot at the Columbia Daily Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see why here in a minute. So the attack would go something like this. Kent would be hit in the head or neck area about 11 or 12 times with some unknown object or the tire tool, as Chuck had said.
Right.
Then as the victim, Kent, is down on all fours from the blows he just took, someone, you know, and that someone, according to Chuck, is Ryan, pulls the victim's belt off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he would have had to have done this, according to the police, by pulling up from the left-hand side, from like reaching around from behind Kent on the left side and grabbing the belt and pulling it up and off.
Right.
They came to this conclusion because two of the belt loops on the left side of Kent's pants were ripped or torn off. Then, using the victim's own belt, Ryan Ferguson strangled...
Okay, hold on a second. So you're saying that they believe that the belt was ripped off of him because there was because the belt loops were broken.
Two of his belt loops were ripped.
Okay.
Then using the victim's own belt, Ryan Ferguson strangled Kent Heitholt. A very short time before 2:26 a.m., a custodian, her name is Shauna Ornt, she stepped outside for a cigarette break or to walk some trash to the dumpster. Now,
or both.
Yeah, my understanding is that sometimes a smoke break and walking trash to the dumpster are the same thing. Anyway.
Great reporting there.
There you go. Happened at the same time.
Right.
Anyway, she is out there and she sees two shadowy figures right near Kent's car. She ran back inside to get her coworker. This is Jerry Trump. She's telling him that there is something going on in the parking lot, and she wanted him to go out there and see what it was. He doesn't really want to do this, but he gives in and he agrees to go check it out. So now the two of them, well, they are standing. They're standing at one of those, like, you know, kind of like a large overhead door. You know, they're standing just past the opening of that.
Okay.
And at first they don't see anything. You know, Jerry Trump's probably like, "Oh, great. I agreed to come out here and check out this thing. You're just freaking out for nothing. There's nothing going on out here." They don't see anything.
Yeah, but
they don't,
sometimes that's scarier. Is when somebody says, "I see somebody outside," and then you go and you start looking and you go, "I see nothing." But sometimes that you're not as relieved.
Mhm. Well, they see nothing at first. They hear nothing at first.
Mhm.
So Jerry Trump decides, he yells out something like, you know, "I see you. You might as well come out. You might as well stand up," or something like that.
"Put your hands up."
Yeah. And two individuals stand up, and one of them is at the front of Kent's car, near the front of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is at the rear of the vehicle. So both custodians witness two what they report as white college-age men now standing near Kent Heitholt's vehicle. They also both said that the man at the rear of the vehicle, he walked to the front of the car and said something to the effect of, you know, "This guy is hurt out here," or "You better call someone, you better call an ambulance," something like that. "That this guy's hurt and he needs help."
So what you're saying is that these two employees of the newspaper,
mm-hmm,
see these two individuals
in the parking lot
ducking down, possibly hiding behind Kent's car.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them kind of walks from the back of the car to the front and then says, "Hey, you better call an ambulance. This guy's hurt out here."
Yeah, he says something like, "Get help. This guy's hurt."
Now, that's something you probably wouldn't say if you hurt the guy.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a strange situation regardless.
Right. If you're going to take somebody's belt off, put it around their throat, and pull as hard as you can so they stop breathing, I don't think you're asking somebody to call an ambulance.
No.
You want that guy dead for some reason.
Yeah, you don't want him to be able to come to and give information about you.
Right.
According to the police report, the employees called 911 at 2:26 a.m.
Right, which we heard that 911 call at the beginning. So if you want to hear it again, go back to the beginning.
Some of the other sport reporters working that night came running out to see what was going on, and they found 46-year-old Kent Heitholt lying face down at the rear of his car. Now, they rolled him over, and they tried to resuscitate him, and of course, unfortunately, it didn't work. The police department was within just a few blocks of the newspaper's parking lot and the newspaper's building. So they arrived very quickly. When they got there, they saw Kent had been severely beaten with some kind of blunt object, and he was strangled and dead at this point.
Well, and we both took a look at the autopsy, and we're not going to go over it in a bunch of details because it's pretty simple to summarize, but they keep talking about this blunt object and being hit well over 10 times. You even hear this in the interrogation with the police and Chucky.
Mm-hmm.
But they keep talking about a blunt object, but there's no skull fractures.
Correct. They don't find any skull fractures on Kent Heitholt.
So it's death by strangulation. His hyoid bone is broken.
Yeah. And there's a little conjecture. There's a little back and forth on the hyoid bone being broken as well. There's one expert that says that he believes the hyoid bone could have been broken because of because he was hit. He was hit about the head and neck area. But mm-hmm. the original expert believes that the hyoid bone was broken during the strangulation process. I don't think that is necessarily important. I think the most important thing that I see in the autopsy itself is, like you said, the number of times that Kent is hit with. They keep referring to it as a blunt object.
Right.
But like you said, no skull fractures. So to me, it's more of he's hit 11 or 12 times with an unknown object.
Right. But what was that expert telling you that one time? You take a 10-year-old girl with a bat or something, and there's going to be skull fractures.
It wasn't something that somebody told me. It was a comment that was made to Ryan Ferguson's father, Bill Ferguson, that he reported elsewhere, stating that, you know, it was strange that there was no skull fractures because an expert, quote unquote, an expert, according to Bill Ferguson, had told him that a 12-year-old girl with a baseball bat, if she hits somebody 11, 12, or 15, even 15 times, you're going to have several skull fractures, not right. just one. You're going to get a few out of that. So he's hit with some kind of unknown object. We'll call it that.
Right. And he doesn't. So he's not going to make it.
Right. And at this point, Chuck Erickson claims that he and Ryan, after having murdered Kent, mm-hmm. that they take this very kind of roundabout way of walking back to the bar. But before they get there, this is at approximately 2:30 a.m., they are at an intersection, and there is a car there stopped at a red light. And inside the car, well, this is somebody that the two boys know, and his name is Dallas Mallory. Dallas is in a car with two young ladies. Mm-hmm. Dallas is actually about 2 years older, I believe.
Than
Chuck and Ryan. Well, Chuck Erickson has a short conversation with Dallas Mallory at the red light.
Yeah, and Chucky says, "How are you in the truck with two women?" That's what he asks.
Well, the light eventually turns green, and away Dallas and the two girls go.
Right.
So now it's back to By George's for Chuck and Ryan.
And we'll get right back to the case of Ryan Ferguson after this quick beer break.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Everyone is still talking about Monopoly Go, for a good reason. It is an absolute hit. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table, like countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Or timed events, offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums. Delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches. Unique playing pieces and so much more. The verdict is in. With Monopoly Go, there's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now free on the App Store and Google Play.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out BetterHelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. It's time to switch.
to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey, a hidden object mystery game with a captivating detective story. It takes you back to the glamour of the 1920s with a diverse cast of characters. You'll step into the role of June Parker and search for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. Use your observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. And customize your very own luxurious estate island. Think expansive gardens and beautiful buildings. Collect scraps of information to fill your photo album and learn more about each character. And you can chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
All right, we're back. Cheers, mates.
Cheers. So, after Ryan and Chuck commit this murder, they, according to Chuck, they go out with the motive of robbery. They attack Kent Heitholt, and they kill him in the parking lot. Now they've taken this roundabout way of making their way back to the bar, and they're back at By George's. According to Chuck, they get back to the bar around 2:45 a.m., and they stay there drinking, dancing, having a good time until about 4 to 4:15 a.m. in the morning.
Well, these bars are open pretty late.
And this only makes sense, right? Because we saw this with the Casey Anthony thing, right? Right. You know, when you kill somebody, the best way to celebrate is to go to a bar and dance and party and have a good time. You know, okay. So now while the two of them are off having a good time,
right,
the police have a murder and a crime scene to deal with here. So the police are going to do a canine search, and I won't go through all of the street names, but basically the police dog is going to track slash follow the trail of the perpetrators, and the dog leads them in the opposite direction as to where Chuck Erickson says that they are going to go. Of course, the dog chase does not turn up the perpetrators, and we do have another problem here with this crime scene. The Tribune's parking lot, well, it has two security cameras. And these security cameras are very obvious. You know, they're the type that would be up on the building. And if you were walking by, they weren't hidden cameras. You know, you would notice them from the street and be aware that the parking lot is under surveillance.
Right.
However, you know, we see this time and time again in these situations. These cameras are not working on this night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the police really have no leads other than the description that they're given from the two custodians, that they are looking for two Caucasian college-age dudes per the description given to them.
Short hair, one maybe blonde, spiked up in the front. And they do a drawing of this at least one of the individuals.
Well, yeah, this is Shauna Ornt and Jerry Trump, the employees at the Daily Tribune. We should point out here that early in the investigation, Jerry Trump's statements were deemed as useless by the police.
Okay.
As his description that he gave to them, it was so vague that it really provided them nothing of value. You know, he basically says, I really couldn't see anything. I really couldn't see anything to describe these guys. Now, as you had mentioned, Shauna Orndt, on the other hand, with the police department's use of what they call like an identikit or an ID kit,
right.
They come up with a composite sketch of the guy who walked from the rear of the vehicle to the front of Kent Heitholt's car. You know, the guy telling them to get help.
Right. And Shauna is, she's younger.
Yes.
And so let's just assume she has better eyes. And Trump,
I think she was, what, 18 or 19 at the time when she saw the scooter?
Yeah,
she was
pretty
down.
Young. And Trump was quite a bit older at the time.
Yes. Now, basically, the way that they come up with this composite drawing, it's that old school identikit. And in some places, they may call it something different. But basically, what they do is, Captain, they'll show you, they have like a flip book. And they're like, they'll show you a bunch of different sets of eyes. And you're like, oh, that looks like his eyes. And they're like, okay, they set those eyes on the face. And then they flip through the book more and they show you a nose. They're like, oh, yeah, that looks like his nose. And yeah. And so you piece together the person's face.
Well, and the problem with this drawing is, again, it's happening very late at night or in the early mornings. It's very dark out, very low lighting. So, and then if, and actually I would say, you know, like during, if it was during the day, obviously, it'd be easier to identify somebody. I think it would be way harder to do this identikit when there's heavy shadows from the streetlights.
Well, I agree. And I don't know that it was fully, like, as far as the way I heard the parking lot described, I'm sure there are dark spots and dark areas.
Mm-hmm.
Shauna states that when she saw the man that she was able to come up with a composite drawing of, that was, she believed to be a, what she considered a well-lit portion of the parking
lot.
Right,
again, but you're going to have these hard shadows.
Of course, because all the lights are coming from above.
And if you watch any of the documentaries on this case, it's, you know, you can see how dark that area would have been.
Yeah, and to go with the composite drawing, you know, she describes the guy as a Caucasian male, about 6 foot tall, 200 pounds, muscular build, wearing a white t-shirt, and has short blonde hair. Now, some other things while we are talking about the crime scene. There was a blood trail, which makes sense because we have a victim that was beaten in the head. Mm-hmm. You would expect a certain amount of blood. So there was a blood trail, but this went in a different direction than what Chuck said he and Ryan had fled the scene. Police found a hair either in or on the hand of the victim. This would be collected and later tested. They did not find the blunt object, or as Chuck had said, the tire tool used to beat Kent. They did not find that at the crime scene. They did find the belt buckle, Kent's belt buckle. It had broken off and was lying there near Kent.
Mm-hmm.
They found fingerprints not matching the victim in and on the victim's vehicle. And one more thing, though. The police found no evidence to suggest Kent had been robbed. So keep in mind, you
trying to find the motive.
Right? Yeah, they're going to check the victim and try to come up with why would this guy be attacked? Well, they don't see any obvious signs that robbery was the motive for this attack or murder. So at this point, they are looking for two young white dudes, mm-hmm. and they don't have a motive to go on at this point in their investigation.
Well, and so we go to the following day. I call this the hangover day. I mean, we got two individuals that were 17 years old. They went partying. Chucky was doing a blow, drinking, doing some Adderall. And he claims that he doesn't remember anything of the events the night before.
Yeah, he has no memory of Halloween night. And also, you know, as we said, there was nothing other than probably one heck of a hangover, like the captain pointed out, that anything had went wrong or anything terrible had happened that night. Chuck did not notice anything unusual. He didn't have any injuries. He didn't have any blood on his clothing. Let's talk about Chuck for a minute, though. Okay. You know, as we had said earlier, he's the same age as Ryan, 17 at the time of this murder, and a high school student. But one big different thing here is, you know, Ryan liked the party, obviously, like some high school students do. However, Chuck had a bit of a history. He had a reputation for blacking out,
right,
and a history and a reputation for getting really blitzed, you know, whether it being drinking or drugs or both. And he would from time to time do something bad or embarrassing. You know, he was known to destroy property or to get in fights.
Right.
And then typically the next day he would have little to no memory of these events or the things that he had did. Well, then people would tell him what he had done. And sometimes these memories, well, they would start to come back to him, and maybe sometimes they would not. But it's my understanding that he had such a reputation for this kind of behavior that often he was not invited to parties because nobody wanted him around.
Yeah, you know, nobody wants the douche canoe breaking furniture.
Right. You don't want that fights. You don't want that guy at your house.
That's not a party.
Yeah, because you're going to get busted by your parents if this guy destroys something.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, you don't want him there if he's going to pick fights with your friends. Getting drunk, destroying stuff, and just being basically a walking party foul,
right,
is what Chuck Erickson would be.
Chucky. Okay. Chucky, a.k.a. Party Foul Erickson.
So before we fast forward, let's go through what happened that night according to Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, this
Okay, so what we need to be clear about this.
Okay.
All the reports that you were just giving, the fine, beautiful people listening to the show, all the reports that you're giving are just from Chucky, but also from the police.
Correct. It's basically the general story that the prosecutor/police pieced together about what took place that night.
Right, but like we all know, there's three sides to every story.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to Ryan, you know, and I didn't want to mix the two stories because not only are they very different, but the night and the way things went down, according to Ryan, let's say it was much less eventful. According to Ryan Ferguson, he and Chuck did go to the bar. They went to By George's. They met his sister there. They had drinks. They left the bar at 1:30 a.m. So we're already seeing a difference in time here.
Right.
Ryan drove Chuck to Chuck's home. And then Ryan continued on to his own home, arriving at his family's house around 1:40 a.m. So a very quick drive from By George's to get Chuck home, and then Ryan takes himself home. Then in the early morning hours after he gets home, from 1:41 a.m. to 2:09 a.m., Ryan calls several friends, and then he goes to bed. He's having murdered no one that evening, being, according to his account,
right,
he's at home, at his family's home during the time of Kent Heitholt's murder.
Yeah. Okay. So we got two completely different stories.
Mm-hmm.
In one story, we got two murderers. And the other story, we got a guy dropping, I dropped my buddy off. We had a couple drinks, dropped him off. And
dropping his really drunk buddy off.
Yeah.
Okay,
not just drunk, but high too. So
how about we fast forward here, Captain? So let's fast forward
to
the
DeLorean.
2003. Now, by this time, the murder, it remained an unsolved mystery. You know, in October of 2003, the local media again began, they were covering the story. They were covering the murder. And Chuck Erickson reportedly had several dreams about the crime after seeing an article in a newspaper. And he couldn't get over the fact that he had been so close in proximity to where someone had been murdered at about the same time.
Right.
And he had almost no memory of that night.
Well, right, because he has that history of blacking out.
Mm-hmm. And about a month later or so, Chuck, he read another article in the local newspaper, but this one included a sketch, the sketch of the possible suspect in the case. Remember, this was the one given to police by the eyewitness, Shauna Ornt, working that night at the Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck thought that the sketch looked like himself. Now he's really starting to get concerned that he was somehow involved in this murder. Now, when he's at this point, when he gets really drunk, he starts telling some people that he thinks he's committed a murder, right, or was at least involved in the murder of Kent Heitholt.
Well, part of this is, you know, you're not fully developed, your frontal cortex and all that stuff. I'm not a doctor, so, but you've taken all those drugs, right? It's going to mess up your brain a little bit. And I think this guy took so many drugs, he fried his damn brain.
And maybe too often. You know, is it the same thing? Are you beating your brain the same level as like getting multiple concussions over and over again with what he's doing? He's blacking out.
Yeah, and how many times is he hit in his head when he's drunk too? I mean, that's another good point.
Mm-hmm. So now he's getting really drunk and he starts telling people that he thinks he may have committed the murder or he's least involved in the murder. Well,
this is definitely not helping, you know, you with your friends there, Chucky.
Yeah, you already had this bad reputation. Yeah. Now
this guy gets drunk, he breaks furniture, he tries to fight people, and then now he's confessing to murders. Don't invite this guy to your party. Rule number one, it's not going to be a good time. It's not going to work out well for you. You're not going to be the popular kid in school. Stop inviting Chucky to the party.
It sounds like he only told two people. These were his friends.
It's because only two people would hang out with the crazy dude.
This is Nick Gilpin and Art Figaro. And the thing is, I don't know if he told these two guys on separate occasions or, you know, if he told them together on several occasions. I'm not certain, but as I've heard it, he's only told two people.
I'm assuming that he told Nick Gilpin this story one time, and then old Captain Gilpin was like, I'm not hanging out with you no more, Chucky.
Well, it's through these two friends that Chuck is... You know, that it's
Let's hold on for a second. Just think about it this way. You're Nick Gilpin, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're hanging out with Chucky, so you don't have a lot of options, right?
Hmm.
This guy breaks stuff, gets in fights, and then he tells you he murdered somebody, right?
Mm-hmm. Or he thinks he did.
How low do you have to be? How bored, how lonely do you have to be to pick up the phone and say,
call him up again.
I'm going to call Chucky up and see if he wants to hang out. You got to be pretty lonely, right?
Get some more details about that murder. Well, it's through these two friends that the police are later notified and told that Chuck Erickson was the one who killed the newspaper reporter, or that was involved in the newspaper reporter's death that took place 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, are you still with me so far? In March of 2004.
Okay. So we have the event happens on Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
2 years later, Chucky's having these dreams.
He starts telling people.
They contact the cops. And even if somebody gets drunk and starts telling you they murdered somebody, call the cops. That's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So they call the cops. Now the cops need to talk to Chucky.
Yeah, so in March of 2004, the Columbia Police Department, they pick up Chuck Erickson and they question him. Mm-hmm. Well, not too long after, and in fact, I believe it was later that same day, they call another police department because by this time, Ryan was off at junior college. And they have Ryan Ferguson arrested as well. Well, these two questionings by police go very differently. And let's talk about this. Let's talk about this starting with Chuck. Okay. So you played some of that interrogation for us.
Right.
And, you know, you see in the questioning, there's a couple different levels of questioning that take place here. First off, there's some questioning that goes down off camera. There's some that goes down on camera. And there's also a questioning period that takes place on camera where they're driving him to the crime scene. And they're driving him around the area so he can, you know, they can point things out to him and they can kind of ask him, where did you guys come from? Did you enter the parking lot this way? Which way did you exit? Where did you go after the murder? You know, can you tell us where his car was parked? Things like that. You know, they have to take him there. Well, regarding the questioning or slash interrogation of Chuck Erickson, it's... What would you say? It's disconcerting, Captain.
It's unethical.
So we have a guy here
The problem is, though, they pick this guy up and he's saying, you know, maybe I was involved in this thing. I don't know. I blacked out that night. I have very little memory. He says something like he's seeing almost snapshots of the night. Well, they're going to it looked to me, Captain, like it started off like kind of a friendly questioning period. And at some point they start getting, you know, we see the typical
here's what the detectives do. They like to spread their legs very wide, mm-hmm. and they like to get in a little tiny baby chair, and then they scoot up really close, you know, so their whole, you know, cock and balls and everything are right on the guy's knee, and then they're looking deep into their eyes, and they start saying stuff like, "You need to tell me the truth. You're not telling me the truth." So that, yeah, starts off friendly. Then they do the whole, "Let me get right in your grill." A little bit later, they back up. They also, once things are going their way, they like to do the lean back. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? Where they are starting to get answers, so they do the lean back.
Well, and they keep you positioned back in the corner. And they stay right in front of you, in your face.
Right, but once they start getting answers, they like to back up and do the lean back. Mm-hmm. You know, like, "Oh, let's make this more comfortable for you. And when you're not telling me the truth, I'm going to make it uncomfortable for you."
Well, and they're also constantly reminding you that you did this, that you are guilty. They will emphasize that word "you," and they will often point at you when they do that, or touch you in some manner to remind you that it is you that is under the microscope.
Right.
It's not a whole bunch of other people that they're looking at. They have circled in on you.
Yeah, so a couple things. One, I feel for the detectives because there's no real leads. They had nothing to go on. All of a sudden, 2 years later, you have this guy, Chucky, coming forward saying, "I'm having these dreams. I have a history of blacking out. I might have been involved."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so yes, the cops need to get to the bottom of this. So, I normally would say, no way, shape, or form should you ever feed details. But I think in this case, I'm going to give him a little bit of a pass because this guy is saying, "I don't know. I don't know a bunch of the details." Where I'm not going to give you a pass is once Chucky brings somebody else into the equation. And once he brings up Ryan Ferguson into the equation, your job now is to, if you want to find out if he's telling you the truth, you need to focus on trying to prove him wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they should have done first.
I'm going to halfway agree with you because it sounds like you're saying if it were just Chuck that was implicating himself and no one else, that it's fine to give up the details.
Fine to give up all the details.
Right, because the problem I have with that is the whole purpose of withholding those details is that so you avoid false confessions. And if you start just giving away information, that's really going to help this person, whether they did it or not, get the right answers, let's say.
Right.
So where do we have a problem with some of these things? Well,
but what I'm saying, though, is you could drive him to the scene. You could do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe try hypnosis or whatever just to see if you can get these memories to come back to the surface. But I'm not telling him. I'm not saying that you should say what the guy was strangled with or details like that. No, definitely not.
Right. And in the beginning of the questioning or interrogation, it appears, and we can see it on TV, we see it on the camera footage, it appears that Erickson, that Chuck has little knowledge of the crime. And at one point, he tells the police, "I could be sitting here fabricating all of this."
Right.
Now, as the captain was hinting towards there, they want some detailed information. You know, they want to know, what was Kent strangled with? Okay. How many times was he hit? What was he hit with? Okay. So let's go through that as such. He states that they took something from Ryan's car and that's what they are going to attack Kent with.
And he assumed like a tire iron.
Yes.
Again, now if you hit, now he was hit about 15 times. If you hit somebody 15 times in the head, the tire iron, there's going to be a skull fracture.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not Chucky because Chucky's a small guy, but you give a pretty good athlete, Ryan Ferguson, a tire iron, there's not going to be skull fractures. It's going to be a mutilated skull.
One thing we should point out, too, though, to paint a bit of a better picture for everybody is I would actually consider both Chuck and Ryan to be smaller dudes. You know, I think what Ryan was 5'8", 5'9", and we have Chuck who's about 5'7". And the reason why I say smaller dudes is that's in comparison to Kent Heitholt. Kent Heitholt was well over 6 foot, and he was a large dude. He played offensive line for some college before he became a sports writer.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I understand that they might be armed with this tire iron or some blunt object or unknown object, but it does seem strange to me that these two teenage boys would pick a very large male victim to attempt to rob.
Yeah, but Ryan was, you know, he's athletic. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly what his height is.
Yeah,
but he definitely looked very athletic.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so as we were stating, they need to know what he was hit with, and furthermore, who hit him and how many times was he hit with this object. Well, here's one thing that I found really strange about that interrogation. You saw this. You know, he says, "How many times was Kent hit? Did you hit Kent?" Once. Yeah. And he's like, "No, come on. We know Chuck that he was hit a lot more than one time."
Mm-hmm.
And then he throws out some other number that's not correct. And then the detective corrects him and he says, "Now we know that you hit Kent 15 times. Is that right?" And eventually Chuck gives into this and says, "Yes, I hit him 15 times."
Right. And this is what I find is so unethical.
Well, not only that, the strange part of this thing here is, Captain, is first of all, it's incredibly unethical. Second of all, the detective fed him information, but fed him wrong information. He says 15 times. The autopsy report states 11 or 12 times. The detective didn't even bother to get the wrong information right.
Right, right.
and so he feeds him some bad information, and we have Chuck validate that and corroborate with that and says, "Yes, you know what? Yeah.
We hit
him 15 times."
But there's a couple times that Chuck is going, "You know what? But I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know if I'm telling you the truth or not."
Right. And then they want to know, okay, what did you use to strangle Kent?
Yeah, I don't know. His t-shirt.
Yeah. And actually I thought when I viewed the full length of the questioning.
The interrogation.
Yeah. I thought that I saw him almost react. He didn't verbally say it, but it looked like his body language was suggesting that he was about to say his hands. You know what I mean?
Because he said, you know, how did Ryan choke him? Like, again, implementing Ryan and not Chucky. And he makes, I saw Ryan hands, you know, kind of the symbol.
Yeah, he makes a gesture about choking with his hands.
The Homer Simpson, "I'm going to choke Bart Simpson" type move. So, yeah. And they were like, "No, that's not right." And he's like, "Well, maybe a t-shirt."
Yeah, because he states that the officer would tell him, you know, it might have been something of Kent's that was used to strangle him. And as you said, at first he says a t-shirt. And he says, "No, it wasn't his t-shirt." And then you hear... And
this is like questioning like a 5-year-old, you know, that like took a crap on in the family room. That's what this questioning reminds me of.
Well, and then you hear him say... So he says, "No, it wasn't a t-shirt, Chuck."
Right.
Then Chuck says, "Well, maybe it was a bungee cord. I don't know because I couldn't see him having a rope in his car."
Right.
Okay.
Doesn't make any sense to me why he would have a rope in his car. Yeah.
So all right. Well, let's examine that. It obviously wasn't a t-shirt.
No. It wasn't with his hands.
Right.
Wasn't strangled with his hands. He wasn't strangled with a t-shirt. Wasn't strangled with a bungee cord. Wasn't strangled with a rope.
And it wasn't something that was taken from the victim's car. It was something that was taken off of the victim.
Right, right. So after 5 wrong answers, maybe you as a detective should go, "Hey, this guy doesn't know jack shit." Yeah. Right?
Yeah, he does. He doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, but right. So at what point does the detective say, "Hey, this is ridiculous. This is nonsense. Not only And here's what they do. They feed him all this information. They feed Chucky all this information. They get a taped confession. They think maybe this can hold up. And then they pull Ryan Ferguson in.
Well, you know, and I'm not even ready to go that far yet because I'm still on the belt thing here. You know, the officer tells, just outright tells him.
Yeah,
he was strangled with his own belt.
Oh, no. He sits back with just this cocky son of a bitch type attitude. And he's just sitting back and he goes, I was kind of holding this from you. I was keeping this back from you. I didn't want to tell you, but it was a belt. That's pretty much exactly what he says, right?
Mm-hmm. And Chuck says something like, well, I don't remember that at all. Like, he seems surprised, like that's the murder weapon, like shocked.
No. He doesn't even understand what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of a sudden, then Chucky says, wait a second.
His own belt.
Right. Not Ryan's belt, but his own belt?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, like flabbergasted. Like this is the first time he's thinking somebody pulled up on Kent, knocked him in his head a 10 times, 11 times, pulled this dude's belt off of him, strangled him with his own belt. You have to be a vicious SOB to do that.
Well, and like you said, his reaction is almost like
getting fired up, man.
Well, Chuck's reaction is almost like, I'm trying to help you out here, guys, but I would not have guessed that, you know, on my best day. I would not have guessed his own belt on my best day.
Right.
So anyway, then now they got to figure out what is the motive. Why would you guys go and attack this large man that you don't know in the middle of a parking lot?
You don't know. Did nothing to you.
And here's the answer that you get. After you go through all of these details, the answer that you get is, well, I guess if we killed him, then I assume we would have done it for money.
Right. But no sign of robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
This is unethical, horrible, horrible police work.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, just like, and we'll talk about this later, you know, a prosecutor, for example, can't just make up fake evidence, right? And there's laws against that. And you can face jail time. Just like I think, you know, now that we require people to tape these interviews, they need to be well aware that if you cross the line or you do some ridiculous, dumb shit, that you can face jail time.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in this case that these detectives doing the interrogation, they deserve jail time because these interrogations were so unethical. You signed up to serve and protect, not to make up bullshit lies and put innocent people behind bars.
Well, the thing here is when they're talking to Ryan Ferguson, it's a much different story. You know, we have Ryan Ferguson basically denying everything.
Well, do you want to just hear that clip?
I did not do anything. I did not see anything. But, and I'm here for murder. Like, I didn't do shit.
Chuck says that he got kind of sick to his stomach after he hit this guy. During that time, he looks over and sees you on top of the guy who's down, and you're choking him out. He says strangling him. You believe this?
I believe Chuck probably had something to do with it.
Well, he said it's true there.
All right, well, I mean, he could very well have been a part of it. I'm not.
You were calm as hell when we come down there. We started talking about the murder. You're like, I didn't do it. Wasn't there. Don't know what you're talking about. If the police pull me and say we're going to talk about a murder, I'm going to be getting about half crazy.
I am f***ing half crazy, dude. I'm sorry I'm good at f***ing hiding my emotions. I'm shaking like a f***ing leaf here. I didn't do anything. I'm about to get in trouble for something I didn't do.
All right. So that's little pieces of the Ryan Ferguson interrogation.
I got to tell you, Captain, I watched that thing and I thought that Ryan actually held it together pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a way that would imply to me that he's guilty, like the detective was trying to point out, you know, stating that, oh, if somebody pulled me in for murder, I'd be mad as hell.
Well, what's crazy to me is
he does appear to be mad as hell to me.
Yeah, but I think a mature way. I mean, one, you're getting questioned about a night that happened two years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So think about that night might be very insignificant to you. And then somebody's questioning you about it, and you're going, well, I don't really remember.
Because the reason why I say that he appears to be mad at times, you know, but controlled,
right,
is mature. That you see him at times where there's like a split second where he'll smack the table. And he's like, man, I'm telling you, I've told you 100 times, I didn't do this, I wasn't there, I don't know what else I can say.
Mm-hmm.
And then second of all, you'll see a couple times where he will raise his voice to the detectives, basically making the same argument. I don't know how to tell you this any differently than I was not there.
Right, you know, but what drives me nuts, and I've said this, I think, since we started looking into this case, is when you watch these tapes, Chucky doesn't make any damn sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
The detectives make no damn sense at all. The only one that's not in this crazy make-believe world is Ryan. He seems like the only one that is speaking with any logical sense.
Right.
So, I mean, just like with the detectives, if you can't get Chucky to remember anything, or if all of his details are different and conflicting of the evidence that you know, that you have studied, he's not your guy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it makes zero logical sense to keep pursuing down that road.
And I like that he says, you know, at some point he kind of gives in, because he says, you know, every time he says, I didn't do this, I wasn't there. Well, then at some point the police start coming back with the argument, well, Chuck was there, and we know Chuck did this, and you were with Chuck, and his answer is the same every time. He goes, okay, well, fine. Maybe Chuck did do this. Maybe right. Chuck was there. I was not.
Right.
I didn't do this. And then, you know, he's asked, you see that part where the one detective comes in and he tries to play the good cop, you know, oh, I have a son your age. And when I look at you, I'm seeing my son. So I'm here to help you get this off your chest. And I'm here to help you talk about this. You know, sometimes we do things that we don't mean to do.
Right.
For whatever reason, we don't know why we do them, you know, but he sticks with it. You know, Ryan sticks with it. He says,
yeah, I would have said, hey, sorry, I'm sorry, I'm not a douche like your son, but I didn't do this.
The thing here is, you know, not only am I innocent of the murder, I'm innocent of having even been there.
Yeah, and never was even there.
Now, the police, they're stuck in this bad situation, okay? You know, it obviously looks like Ryan's in a bad situation and Chuck is in a bad situation. But the police, unbeknownst to the two boys, the police, they need something. Because as we pointed out earlier, you know, they don't have a lot to go on other than this confession that they've got from this Chuck Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person that's supposedly with him, Ryan Ferguson, is saying the exact opposite. I was not there. I'm not guilty of anything. They need someone to somewhat back up Chuck's story. Okay, so who would have...
Well, and also their story. It's a collaborative story at this point.
You're exactly right. Who would have seen you there that night? Oh, mm-hmm. Well, you know, Chuck points out that at some point after the murder, while we were leaving and going on our way back to the bar, at this intersection, we saw this guy that we knew, and his name is Dallas Mallory. We saw him. He was at a red light in a vehicle with two girls. I had a brief conversation with him at the intersection before the light turned green and he took off. Well, they bring in this Dallas Mallory, and he says, I did not see those. I did not see Chuck. I did not see Ryan. I saw neither of those guys at an intersection in the early morning hours of November 1st. He goes on to say, I didn't see those guys on Halloween night either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the police keep coming back to him and they say, well, we know, Dallas, we know that you saw them because Chuck keeps saying that he saw you, that he had a conversation with you. And at some point, Dallas is saying, you know, like you pointed out, Captain, this is at least 2 years ago. So Dallas is like, he's confused. He's like, well, how about this? If Chuck says he saw me, then what was I wearing that night? Well, they go to Chuck and they talk to Chuck, and Chuck says, well, Dallas was dressed up for Halloween to go to the Halloween parties. He was dressed up as a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the detectives go back to Dallas Mallory and they say, he says he saw you. You were dressed like a police officer. And Dallas Mallory says, I was wearing a police uniform that night. That was my character for the Halloween parties. Then I must, if he says that that's what I was wearing, then I must have seen those guys that night.
Right. Because how would he know?
Mm-hmm.
So now that they have somebody backing up Chucky's story and their story, their combined efforts to create this elaborate story, they're going to charge Chucky and then they're going to go on trial to charge Ryan Ferguson.
Yeah. And I think let's cover that in tomorrow's episode. We should talk about how this gets to trial, talk about the trial itself, the things that they got right, the things they got wrong, and where this ends up getting us in the end.
Well, yeah, tons to dive into tomorrow. Until then, check out truecrimegarage.com. Go to the store page. We got the tank tops for sale. We got the V-necks. We got the logo tees, some beer mugs, a bunch of different stuff. Check that out.
All right. We will see everybody back here tomorrow in the garage. Until then, be good, be kind, and don't let them.
At Founders Brewing Company, we set out to create a beer that lets you embrace the unconventional. Mortal Bloom is a radiantly beautiful, hazy IPA that will wrap your taste buds with intense citrus and tropical notes of pineapple and mango. Coming in at 6.2% ABV with big aromatics and no bitterness, it's the perfect beer, if we do say so ourselves. Visit foundersbrewing.com to find Mortal Bloom Hazy IPA.